Hey everyone, it's me, Amy Walter. Before we start the conversation, I wanted to let you know that this podcast is brought to you by the Cook Political Report. If you are interested in more of our great content, consider subscribing. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is only available to new subscribers. Welcome to the Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. So I've been trying to set up this conversation with Terrence Woodbury for a long time. The reason is that he's this pollster who has done some amazing work, specifically with demographic groups that made a big difference in the presidential race last year, but also in previous cycles. Black voters, voters of color, and younger voters. And if many Democrats were surprised by the erosion in support among what they thought was a reliable Democratic base, well, Terrence has been observing the slide for years, particularly among men of color, a group he calls the new swing voter. As a pollster to the Kamala Harris campaign, he and his company hit strategies at a front row seat to how voters felt about Harris, Donald Trump, and the Democratic Party as a whole. So, what I wanted to do was sit down and have him revisit the results of 2024, but really to look forward to what he's hearing now from voters with Donald Trump in office and what he thinks the Democratic response should be to the Trump era. Terrence Woodbury, officially his title is co-founder and president of Hit Strategies. It is a public opinion research firm. And I sat down with him on Wednesday, March 12th, for this conversation. Terrence Woodbury, hello. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, Amy. Thanks for having me again.
Oh, it's great to catch up with you, really, because I just don't know anyone who is doing the breadth and depth of work, especially with younger voters of color like you are. And so before we go forward, I do want to just go back for a couple minutes and talk about 2024 and your assessment of what happened in that election, and specifically the movement among younger voters of color and specifically younger men.
Yeah. Look, I mean, we were honored to serve as a pollster for the Harris campaign in 2024, specifically focused on Black voters and young voters. And because of the efforts of the campaign, we were able to close pretty significant gaps. The underperformance that we saw when Joe Biden was at the top of the ticket, the Harris campaign was able to close, you know, almost a 20-point gap with Black voters, a 14-point gap with young voters. But there just was not enough time to reverse trends that had existed far before this campaign started. Trends that existed far before Joe Biden was president. We've been seeing underperformance, erosion amongst base voters. And so in the 2024 cycle, we saw Democrats do worse, get less votes from every single group that we would consider our base. We got less votes from Black voters, from young voters, from voters of color, from urban voters, from working class voters. Anyone that you would consider a Democratic base voters, Democrats did worse with that group. And so I think that reflects, there's a lot of work to do. Not just in this opposition period, but in the rebuild going into the midterm.
Right. To your point, this wasn't just one group of voters that didn't show up or that was dispirited. In fact, I think the only group, Terrence, that improved their margin with Democrats were white college voters, maybe white college women specifically, but certainly that was about it. Exactly. In terms of improving the vote from Biden. So let's dig into that, this idea that this defection, if you will, from Democrats started long before the 2024 campaign. You've done a lot of work, a lot of research with these voters, really going back. I'm as we just discussed, you before this recording, you've been in business since 2018, but you've been in the field for longer than that. So what's going on here? What's been happening with these voters, and what are Democrats doing wrong, or what are Republicans doing right?
Yeah. You know, we've been digging pretty deep into this, and there's a couple of things happening here. One is the number one reason why Republicans are doing better with men of color, who I believe are emerging as the new swing voters, is because they're spending money trying. Right? There's an effort. There's an investment going after young men of color. Namely these like more cynical, disengaged voters. We call them rightfully cynical because they're lowest education, lowest per capita income. They are closest to the pain, right? And Republicans are seizing on that pain, one, by telling them that Democrats have failed them, two, by telling them that their problems are because of all these other people, because of immigrants, because of trans people. But three, and this is where I do think that there's some room for Democrats to improve here. They're appealing to them on cultural issues. They're appealing to their values, to values of masculinity, where we say, you know, it's not all toxic. There's a role for masculinity on the left too. We need to define what that role is. But also, you know, values like spirituality, self-reliance, and generating generational wealth. That their attempts to appeal there. Reaping benefits. There's ROI, return on investment, and so that's a part where we got to dig in and start to reassemble this coalition.
So for Democrats who say, "Oh, look, this is just a Trump thing," you know, he has this appeal as the business guy, the outsider. Your assessment is it goes beyond just Trump. Like Republicans after Trump are still going to have these same messages and appeals.
That's right. It's because it's not just after Trump, Republicans during Trump, right? We see Republicans down ballot doing twice as well with men of color. Tom Tillis got twice as many black men's votes as he previously got. David McCormick in Pennsylvania got twice as many black men's votes as the previous Republican candidate for Senate. And so it's not unique to Trump. I do think it started with Trump. It started there because Trump was the first one to begin making those investments. But Republicans, like we've seen the Republican Party do on every issue, they are following Trump's lead. And in Trump's Republican Party, they are making a coordinated effort to go after young men. And there's a return on that investment.
And how much of the movement is also that not only have Democrats maybe not invested in the same way, but the assumptions that Democrats made about this being, as you said, these are our base voters. So on the issues, they'll never leave us because we're clearly superior, or that we can sort of guilt these younger men into continuing to vote for Democrats. I'm curious your take on that, as well as, you know, during the campaign, President Obama basically admonishing young men, saying, y'all have to get over your hesitancy to vote for women.
Yeah.
Yeah. What you made of that?
Yeah. Well, one thing about Barack Obama is when he speaks, they hear it, right? He breaks through the noise. Whether they like it or not, they hear it. They all heard that. And for some black men, it was motivating, right? They wanted to prove him wrong. But, you know, I'm glad you brought up that example, because in every focus group that I conducted, there was at least one person that was willing to admit that they had concerns about voting for her because she was a woman. And what I recognize, but oftentimes these were the same men of color that would express that that women shouldn't have to go through this type of rigorous politics, that women should be protected and cherished from these types of things. There was what I started to recognize was that just because men of color believe that men should be head of household, and many women of color agree with that. In fact, almost a majority of black women agree with that. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're sexist, and that there was a requirement here to have a conversation with men, the same way Barack Obama did in 2008, when he recognized that racism had the potential to undermine his candidacy. He didn't wag his finger at white people and shame them for being racist. He got on TV and said, you know, even my grandmother, who I love the most, holds unconscious bias. And this is an opportunity for America to rise above that, to not be black states and white states. And America, you know, attempted to rise above that. Well, we needed to do the same thing with men in this election, to explain how the role of gender is evolving, how society is evolving and how that means that their role is evolving in it. And how, in fact, we might need them now more than ever as we attempt to elect the first woman president. And I just don't think that we engaged men in those conversations. And so you start to see, you know, 33% of men of color saying that men are losing their position in society, and that we have to lean into that and not shame them for feeling that way, but give them an exit ramp and give them a role in this new evolving society.
You've also talked about the generational gap as being maybe even more profound than the gender gap. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so the same way we've seen 2 or 3% of 2 or 3% more Black men supporting Republicans over time. In fact, I'll give you some of the numbers here. So in 2012, the last time Barack Obama was on the ballot, 87% of Black men supported Barack Obama. In 2016, when Hillary Clinton was on the ballot, 82% of Black men supported Hillary Clinton. So it's not just sexism. Well, in this election, only 77% of Black men supported Kamala Harris. Pretty considerable drop. Well, the same thing is happening amongst younger voters, right? Latino men under the age of 50, there was a 20-point drop in support for Joe Biden in 2020 compared to Kamala Harris in 2024, a 20-point drop. These are not marginal changes. These are not within the, you know, within the margins. These are determining the outcome of the election. The reason I think it is more profound amongst young people is because millennials and Gen Z have now emerged as the largest voting bloc in America. They are the electorate. I keep saying young people don't have next, they have now. You know, this is their time. They're also the most diverse voting bloc in America. And they do lead with their identities in politics. Young people don't want to have a post-identity politics. This is where Democrats' response to what happened in 2024 seems a little bit off to me, that they want to avoid the culture issues, avoid the identity issues. Well, in fact, we need to lean into it and define it, redefine it in our way.
So what does that look like, Terrence?
I think it is when Republicans put forth a vision of society that is rigid gender definitions and traditional family roles and limited immigration, I think that Democrats' response can't simply be no. It can't simply be we don't want that. It has to be a presentation of a multiracial society as we would see it. What is the role of immigration in that society? What are the role of genders in that society? What is the role of men and women, of sexuality? Because unless we do that, unless we present an alternative, we're just asking them to vote against something. And I don't know, and I work for the Democratic Party, I don't know what our vision is on some of these things. I know what our policies are. You know, I know what we want to vote, what we want a majority of votes to do, but what is the society that we're trying to achieve? Because I know exactly what Society MAGA is trying to achieve.
How do you come to an answer on that, Terrence, as a party? And, you know, especially when you're the minority party in Congress, there's not a presidential election until 2028. What should Democrats be doing to get to that place, that policy, that vision?
Yeah. You know, and this is not a self plug for Hit Strategies to do more research, but we need more research. I don't claim to have the answer to that. I have some examples of it from the past. You know, I think Barack Obama reimagined society to not be red states and blue states, to not be Black and white. You know, he reimagined a unified society where we have more in common than we do that separates us. I think Bernie Sanders has attempted to reimagine society where you shouldn't have to pay for some of these things that are in fact rights to you, that we should not live in a society where the wealth gap is as big as it is, where the top 1% of the top 1%, to use the Bernie line, there's something seriously wrong in this country when the top 1% of the top 1%. Well, that I think that one, we need research. Two, we need a visionary leader to present that vision. It's something that this very diverse coalition can unite behind.
A quick break, and we'll be back with Terrence Woodbury. It It might be a political odd year, but here at the Cook Political Report, we're as busy as ever. Over the last few weeks, we've rolled out our race ratings for governor, the House, and Senate. It's not too early to think about next year's midterms, and we have everything you need to know about these races. But this is only available to Cook Political Report subscribers. So don't wait. Join us. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers.
I mean, I'm curious on your take on this. Look, until Barack Obama came onto the scene, the Democratic coalition in 2004 actually looks a lot like the Democratic coalition of 2020 and in some ways in 2024, right? That I feel like so many folks and both parties, but certainly on the Democratic side, if you came up in the era of Obama, the assumption was this is the way things have always been, that Democrats always win young voters by these huge margins, always are going to win Black voters by 87, 88 points, as opposed to he was a unique figure that was able to coalesce these voters in a way that no one else has been able to do yet. So is the goal then to try to reimagine the coalition, or is it to say we've got to get back those people that we lost to Republicans?
Yeah, that's a great question, Amy. You know, because of the transformative figure that Barack Obama was that you just described and his ability to consolidate so much of this young and minority vote, matching that with an equally but opposite transformative figure in Donald Trump, who has proven the ability to mobilize white rural voters in ways that we couldn't imagine. Look, as we pour through this data, as voter files are getting updated, I'm beginning to realize that Kamala Harris, in fact, got more votes than Joe Biden got in four of the seven swing states that she lost. She got more votes than Joe Biden got when he won in Michigan, Nevada, Georgia, and North Carolina, but lost all of those states. And what that tells me is that she's not just we're not just losing our voters. He's mobilizing new voters.
Right.
And those two transformative figures, Barack Obama and Donald Trump, the impact that they've had on our electorate, I don't think anyone can predict whether or not this is a realignment, whether we revert to some type of norm. Right. I can't predict that yet, but the patterns have been quite volatile and they are beginning to impact the voters that I focus on the most, young people and people of color, in ways that are still shocking to me.
So when you're talking to these voters, I know you're still doing a lot of focus groups since the election. Well, what do they think of the Democratic Party? Like who do they think the Democratic Party is?
There is a palpable frustration. There's a frustration, especially amongst base voters, who not only feel like we lost in 2024, they feel like we continue to lose in 2025. We're still losing every day. We didn't just lose an election. We're losing the things that we care about every day. And there's a frustration with a Democratic response that is, that's why we have to vote more next time. They don't want to wait to oppose. They don't want to wait until the next election to stop what is happening. And this is why I've encouraged a lot of the Democrats that we work with to not act like the minority party, but to act like the opposition party. And opposition is a verb, it's an action, right? And you know, I've worked in parliamentary politics in the Caribbean and Jamaica and Trinidad. And when the party that's in opposition loses an election, they stand up a shadow government and they present an alternative to everything that the government is doing. They respond to everything that the government is doing, not just with, no, we don't like that, but also, here's what we would be doing different.
That's right.
And that's what I think Democratic voters, especially these young and diverse base voters, they want to oppose. They don't necessarily want to protest. They don't necessarily want to march in the streets, but they do want to demonstrate. They want to boycott. They want to use their money to send a message, and they want Democratic leadership that represents a strong opposition and not just a minority party.
So what is the reaction to some of the things that Donald Trump has been doing thus far? Curious to get that from your, again, if you're speaking to base voters, I assume you're also speaking to some of the Trump voters from 2024, what they think of Trump rolling back a lot of the DEI, Trump's rhetoric on going after the federal government, all of those things with the Doge and Elon Musk. Like, what are they giving him some benefit of the doubt? Is it what they expected? Are they surprised?
Yeah, for the most part, people are not surprised by what he's doing. Democrats were very effective at raising the profile of Project 2025 until it had a near universal name ID. Everyone in the country knew what Project 2025 was. And so I think that it demonstrates to a lot of folks that he's doing what he said he was going to do. He's doing what Democrats warned that he was going to do, what Kamala Harris warned that he would do. So a lot of people aren't surprised. I do think it is now incumbent upon Democrats to connect the dots, that we can't expect people in America to understand how cuts to federal government in Washington affects them.
Right.
But we can connect the dots on how cuts to FAA while planes are falling from the sky affects them. Cuts to the weather, to the National Weather Service, as we're experiencing the most severe weather emergencies affects them. Cuts to Department of Education as students are struggling to keep up with their global counterparts, or cutting vaccine research as we are facing a measles outbreak. We have to now connect the dots for people that it's not just thousands of folks in Washington losing jobs in a graceful government, but that these are services that protect and keep us safe, and that cutting them will present clear and present danger for their families.
And what about the DEI rollbacks? And as you said, there's this frustration from, especially from younger voters and others, that they don't necessarily want to protest, but there are boycotts, right? There's the Target boycott, for example. What are you hearing?
I'm glad you brought this back up, because DEI is a unique example in that even Black voters who you would expect to be most outraged or, you know, most frustrated by the rollbacks of DEI are not expressing that type of frustration for a couple of reasons. One, we aren't demonstrating how this is going to hurt them, right? And two, Black folks have had mixed results from DEI and affirmative action. You know, it's not lost on Black people that they have not been the main beneficiaries of these programs. And so if all these programs are in place and my life is not getting better, then damn the program. You know what I mean? Then tear it
Terrence,
apart.
I literally just had this conversation with Black man who was saying exactly that. Like, okay, so my company is rolling back DEI, and yet it's been going on for I don't know how many years, and I'm still the only Black guy sitting in this room. Right?
That's right.
So what were we even, like, I guess we had a program, but right. Doesn't look any different today than it did 10 years ago or whatever it is that you started it.
That's exactly right. I mean, you're not going to find a Black, you'll be hard pressed to find a Black person in America that doesn't want to live in a meritocracy, that does not want to live in a merit-based society. Yep. What Democrats are failing to do is connect the dots on how, you know, DEI programs and affirmative action are an attempt to achieve a merit-based society, to remove the barriers of people that have worked too hard, that have had to work twice as hard to get half as far, that's what these programs were envisioned to do. And even if they're not achieving that, we need to reform and fix them and not destroy and dismantle them. But again, we have to connect those dots. And frankly, this is a conversation that Republicans have been having with the American people for several cycles now. I mean, they changed the name from CRT to DEI, you know what I mean? From critical race theory to DEI, from affirmative action to DEI. But they're having the same conversation with the American people, that Democrats are too woke. And when my Democratic clients come to me and ask, why are Democratic voters not more outraged about DEI? I ask them, what did you say to defend critical race theory? What did you say to defend the fact that you're too woke? When we were silent on all of these issues, when we don't show up to the culture war, we don't win, we just concede. And now we've conceded their vision of America. And even our side is buying into that zero-sum politics. Even Black people believe that they are getting less because LGBTQ community is getting more, or because the immigrant, the Hispanic communities are getting more, that we've allowed his zero-sum vision of the world to define America, and we have not offered an alternative.
Right. And it's the same thing with the response on trans issues and gender identity.
That's right.
Is that hitting, again, this is the stereotype, well, that it is more effective with communities of color who are going to be more culturally conservative than it is in sort of liberal white enclaves?
Yeah, look, I have a stat here I want to share with you because I think it does speak to exactly this. This is a poll that we did with Black voters where 59% of Black voters agree with this statement. Gains for the LGBTQ community have sometimes come at the expense of the Black community.
Wow.
59% of Black voters believe that, right?
Yeah.
What that tells me is that, you know, these are not voters that are anti-LGBTQ, right? And this is the misperception of the trans ad that Donald Trump ran that said that she's for them and they and I'm for you. Well, the rest of the ad said that they're using your tax dollars to pay for trans surgeries. It's not about being anti-trans. It's about them getting more so that you can get less. It's a resource. It's a zero-sum resources conversation that he's having. And he puts different people in the problem statement to prove that you get less because immigrants are getting more. You get less because trans are getting more. Well, if Democrats are not going to offer not just an alternative, but a reason for their pain, if it's not because of trans people, and it's not because of immigrants, and it's not because of criminals, then why does my life suck? Tell me, you know, and if you can't tell me why it sucks, then how can I trust you to unsuck it? You know?
So that's going to be the bumper sticker, unsuck my life. There you go. I think we've already figured it out. And you're right, the transformative figures, whether it's Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, answered that question.
That's right.
Right.
And even Bernie Sanders, you know, this is what, yeah. You know, he offered a vision of society that is different than how it is now. It should be like this. And your life wouldn't suck if I could achieve the vision that I have for America, then your life wouldn't suck anymore. And this is why there's this Bernie Trump voter that confuses the hell out of Washington, D.C., because what they were voting for were disruption.
100%.
They weren't voting for policies. They hate the system that has failed them. And these were the only two people that were offering to blow that system up.
I think that's absolutely right. And this is what's going to be fascinating, I think, Terrence, as we go through these next few months here, as we get into 2026, is it seems at least that Donald Trump is very committed to pushing on through with this vision, right? That I told you guys, tariffs and redefining the role of government and literally taking a chainsaw to our federal government was going to be able to make your life better, right? So you got to just trust me on this. It's going to work out, right?
I mean, he's even hinting now that, you know, there's going to be a little bit of pain before
it gets better.
There might be a little recession before it gets better. Costs might go up before they go down, but trust me on this.
Right. And that to me is the sort of fascinating piece, right? Because usually politicians, as soon as it gets a little uncomfortable, they go, oh, you're right. We should probably back off. I guess that's the question is how much time do you think voters give him to work it out if they were saying, indeed, I did want somebody to do something different. And he's acting like somebody that isn't a traditional politician. It may be rough in the short term, but my life isn't great right now anyway.
That's exactly right. Look, there was a voter who said to me in a focus group over a year ago, my hood didn't get any better under Obama. It didn't get any worse under Trump. So what has Biden got to do with me? You know, this is I've done this cycle last year. Well, to your point, for folks that are closest to the pain, whose communities don't change that much from president to president, they're also not feeling more pain now, you know, than they have. The same way they're not feeling all of the benefits of Biden's efforts, they're not feeling the pain of Trump's efforts. And I think they are willing to blow up a system. They're willing to break, you know, USAID and NATO and these four-letter words out of Washington that have never done anything for them. Break it. I don't know. Like maybe maybe breaking it will produce a different result unless Democrats connect the dots and say by cutting USAID, we increase the cases of measles around the world and pandemics don't have borders. Pandemics don't stay in country lines. You know, this is a part of what we're doing is to protect the, is to protect America, even our investments around the world. We have to connect those dots and stop expecting Americans to just to just draw their own conclusions.
Right. And so that's going to be a fascinating debate, Terrence, when you're listening to all the Democratic groups now coming out with their answers for going forward. I know, for example, there was some reporting on, you know, groups like Third Way and others talking about we've got to stop being so identity focused, right? That I can't remember what their actual term was, but something about we've got to meet voters outside of the identity issue, be known for more than just identity politics. But your point is bigger and broader than that, which is, it seems to me, Democrats need to meet the moment, which is one in which disruption is actually appealing.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And Democrats spent the last four cycles arguing that they were the party of status quo.
Yeah.
And the norm. And is that still the right message?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think two things you said there. Democrats have been seen as the defender of the system and people hate the system.
Right.
And even as Donald Trump dismantles the system, takes a chainsaw to it, our response can't be put it back. You know, they don't want it back. They don't want it back to the way it was. You, the Department of Education hasn't been, you know, ideal for most voters. I hold Department of Education loans. They are a hassle. I would not have been able to buy my house without an FHA loan. These are the things that that government services have allowed me to achieve or pursue the American dream. And those are the programs and systems that he's dismantling. But if those systems, if people have had mixed results from it, from these programs and these systems, then we have to present a better version. And so I do think that that disruption is going to be a part of it. But the idea that we need to abandon identity politics, the idea that anyone that believes that America is not in a culture war is oblivious to what is happening in our politics. Whether Democrats started the culture war, whether woke started, we are in it. And we don't have an option to not show up for it because, again, young people who are now the dominating force in American politics lead with their identities. Their identities are their politics. And so we need an answer for them, or we're going to allow the right to continue to define identity in America.
Right. Is there somebody, and you can maybe even name one of your clients, or maybe they're not a client of yours, but that you see out there right now on the Democratic side, who's connecting the dots, who kind of gets where you have been going in this conversation?
I think that that is going to require a pretty transformative visionary. And I think that the kind of figures that we've listed, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, have represented that. I do think that there are some Democrats that are meeting the moment.
Yeah.
But mainly that moment is outrage. And I think that that's enough for now, right? The first reaction has to be, this shit is unacceptable. Let's start there. And so when I ask voters in focus groups, who is fighting for you? Who's representing your voice? The names that they often start with nobody. And then we probe and push and say, well, if you had to come up with a name. And the names that we often hear are people like Jasmine Crockett, the congresswoman from Texas, AOC, congresswoman from New York, and Bernie Sanders. And what those three have in common, even though their policies and ideologies may not all align, it is outrage with the way things are going. And I think that voters, especially Democratic voters, want to see more expression of that outrage. It's like what we were able to tell folks that were working on Michelle Obama's convention speech. Voters don't want to go high anymore. they are outraged with what's happening, and they want to swing back. They want to fight back. And so there are some folks that are rising to that occasion. And I expect that we're going to see more of that.
Right. So the idea of let's try to meet Donald Trump in the middle. He has some good ideas, but how he's doing it is not right, is not the answer. Is that what you're saying? He wants to disrupt. I want to disrupt. He's doing it badly. I will do it better. Is that kind of the...
I'm sure there are some policies where Democrats should be able to work with Donald Trump, but that's not what he's doing. He's not operating, you know, a co-equal branch of government where he requires collaboration with Congress. He's operating from the power of his pen and executive order. The only way to oppose that is to oppose it.
Yeah.
Is to take action. Right. Is the minority can't oppose it, but opposition can, you know?
Right.
And so I think people are looking for more of that.
If you think about the midterm elections, they are always a reflection of voters' perceptions of the party in power, right? Mm-hmm. Much more so than what they think about the party out of power. Does the message that is effective in a midterm become equally effective in 2028? I know we're only, 45 days into this tenure of Donald Trump, but seems to me the issues of the economy and the chaos around tariffs are really driving not just the conversation right now, but having the biggest impact on people in their day-to-day lives, right? Whether it's your 401k or what stuff costs. Can you put that message together about the economy with some of the other things you've been talking about and to make this sort of cohesive message? Or is it just because it's a midterm election, just make it about not being the in party and make 2028 the real significant sort of Democratic Party thesis theory?
I am concerned about a strategy that expects Republican unpopularity to deliver a Democratic majority. That concerns me. One, because Donald Trump's favorability and approval ratings are higher now than they've ever been. But then the other thing is, I do think that his greatest strength has been the economy, and that is quickly becoming his greatest weakness because he's not addressing it. Because stock markets are plummeting, because Doge is cutting thousands of jobs, and because he's beginning to openly acknowledge that tariffs are going to raise cost.
Yeah.
Even after promising that he would, quote, defeat inflation on day one. And so I do think that there's a world in which and where Democrats can make his greatest strength become his greatest weakness. I do suspect that economy will continue to be the number one issue. Economy is the number one issue in every election, right? It just means something different every time. Economy in 2024 meant cost. Economy in 2026 might mean markets. It might mean employment rates. It might mean, the 401ks and stock markets. We don't know yet, but it is going to be incumbent on Democrats again to connect the dots on how what he's doing is making your cost higher or making your retirement lower, your value of your home lower. We have to connect those dots still. And that'll be the I believe is the winning message for 2026.
Terrence, as usual, this has been chocked full of really great insights plus data. I mean, the poll guy can't leave without at least throwing some numbers in.
That's exactly
right. Thanks so much for taking the time to do this. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Annie. Always a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You are our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, O-D-D, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman. Thank you, and we'll talk soon.